Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the attack on the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado and look into the extent to which politicians like Carly Fiorina are responsible for inciting impressionable people with easy access to military-style firearms by broadcasting emotionally charged falsehoods about harvesting baby parts in order to inflame the evangelical constituency to vote for her in the Republican primaries. Frances Kissling, the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy and the former president of Catholics for Choice, joins us to discuss who has blood on their hands following the demonization of Planned Parenthood by Republican politicians who are prepared to shut down the government to punish Planned Parenthood for what they were purported to be doing in a deceptive and manipulative sting video produced by anti-abortion zealots. Then we'll examine a number of political crises in Turkey that are either created by or exacerbated by President Erdogan, who has picked a fight with Vladimir Putin, reignited a war with the Kurds that has led to the public assassination of a prominent pro-Kurdish human rights lawyer, and is using the refugee crisis as leverage to get concessions on joining the EU and aid from Europe for keeping refugees in Turkey. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at Columbia University and the author of The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East, joins us to discuss how much Turkey's problems are compounded by its polarizing leader. Then finally, with Republican presidential candidates pandering to nativism and spewing Islamophobia as the Republican House and most of the country's governors close the door on refugees from Syria, we will speak with Martin Goldsmith, the author of Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and A Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance, about the tragic similarities his story has to today's callous treatment of refugees fleeing murderous regimes. And joining us now is Frances Kissling, is the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs at religiondispatches.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frances Kissling.
Hi, good to be with you.
And Frances, what's your take on who has blood on their hands? There's been a peculiar silence now from the Republican presidential candidates who are beating the drum and beating up on Planned Parenthood, particularly the presidential debate before last was just an absolutely extraordinary demagoguery went on, particularly from Carly Fiorina, who challenged Hillary Clinton to look at a video that she described that simply isn't real.
It didn't exist.
And now you have this fellow that shot up the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado and killed a policeman and two innocent people that were in the clinic. He said to the police, apparently, no more baby parts. So it's not that difficult to see the connection there, surely.
Well, I mean, I do think we have to be a little careful with this guy because it's not yet totally clear, although I think, as you say, the handwriting is on the wall. He didn't choose to go into the dollar store next door I don't know if there was a dollar store next door, into one of the other stores that are adjacent to Planned Parenthood from which to shoot. He chose Planned Parenthood, and I think that we're definitely going to find that there's some serious motivation there related to Planned Parenthood. But I think that what we have seen in the last year or so, most particularly, and especially after the sting operation around Planned Parenthood's laudable participation in harvesting fetal tissue for research, which was presented so badly, I think we have seen such a vehement attack on Planned Parenthood and the desire, of course, to close it down entirely and lie after lie after lie perpetrated that that just about everybody who has participated in that bears some responsibility for how their words are taken, and particularly how their words are taken in a country where we see so much violence going on. So the candidates, the Republican candidates, of course, you know, Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, those three in particular have been, in my opinion, the most vicious in the way in which they talk about Planned Parenthood. And the Republican Congress has equally been, you know, vicious in terms of its intent to close Planned Parenthood down completely. You can't call people the kinds of things that Planned Parenthood has been called and then be shocked when somebody takes the law into their own hands and either kills people or otherwise harms them.
But specifically, this sting video that was done under illegal circumstances, they were posing as buyers of fetal tissue, and it was highly edited, and it was very, very deceptive, using stock footage mixed up with real footage. And this definitely provoked a huge response amongst the Republican Congress and amongst these presidential candidates. If you get a bunch of people to get together and make a phony video, it reminds me of, in fact, of Citizens United. That was a phony, trumped-up video against Hillary Clinton, and yet it ended up being the basis of a Supreme Court ruling. So I see a methodology here where Republican political activists create a piece of political fiction. It's seized upon by the Republican Congress and Republican politicians running for president, and they just go off like rabid dogs and scream from the rafters. And then when something terrible happens, like some impressionable citizen out there who's got ready access to firearms, acts upon the idea that it's morally righteous to stop the harvesting of baby parts, you have what you have.
Yes. And I think, you know, we see this in terms of, if you look at the history of these videos, the first people who got to see these videos before they were released publicly were Republican members of Congress. And the folks who produced them took them to Congress, showed them to Congress, and then they were released later. And, you know, the people, the candidates as for president in the Republican Party are reasonably intelligent people who are, I hate to say it, but reasonably intelligent people who really are malevolent when it comes to issues related to reproductive health, to abortion, even to family planning. And they clearly will lie, because some of the deception here is so totally obvious. I mean, the Carly Fiorina thing about a video that didn't exist. It is really unconscionable behavior. And I think that the tragedy of it all, in some sense, is that this is not going to make any difference. They are going to be asked. They were asked. Carly Fiorina was asked on the morning programs. Ben Carson was asked on the Sunday morning programs today. What about this? And they all sidestepped it. I mean, Fiorina, in fact, used it as an opportunity to continue to slander Planned Parenthood by saying, well, we know that they were selling baby parts, body parts, because they have now stopped selling body parts. You know, so her first reaction was not horror at what had happened or any self-reflection on whether or not the way in which she talks about this issue could contribute to it. It was to use it as an opportunity to continue to slander Planned Parenthood. These are people who will, and not just Republican candidates, but a branch of the anti-abortion movement. These are people who will stop, who really believe that lying in the service of something they think is a bad thing is a perfectly acceptable way to behave. I saw the same thing earlier when the slaying of doctors and shooting of doctors was common. I called out the Catholic bishops at that time who had the same kind of rhetoric not just about Planned Parenthood, but about abortion, abortion providers, abortion doctors, the way in which the individuals who provide abortion services are talked about, the dehumanization of them by the candidates and by others, and the bishops in this case, contributes to the fact that they deserve to be murdered.
And again, I'm speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics and Social Policy, and the former president of Catholics for Choice. She's a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project. She writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.org. Well, this is what I think is particularly troubling about the anti-abortion movement, particularly as it gets more and more zealous, that it seems to be all about a kind of moral free ride, that you get to be self-righteous but not have to take any responsibility, and that this thinking can lead you to an exemption of taking a human life, because after all, these terrible people are taking human lives.
Exactly, and you know, you can lie about anything. That really is it. I mean, many of these of the Republican legislators who are passing bills that require, you know, any and all forms of deception, any and all forms of restriction are permissible because you believe something is evil. So you can lie about what kind of facilities are necessary in order to perform abortions, about whether abortion is safe or dangerous. You can lie to women about whether or not they will get breast cancer. They won't from having an abortion. You can tell them the procedure is dangerous. It is not. You can tell them that fetuses feel pain. They don't. I mean, there is no limit to what you can say to end abortion, and of course to defund Planned Parenthood. No limit. And if there is no limit in terms of what you can say, it's a very short step to there is no limit to what you can do. And that's that. When we see this kind of incident, that we realize that that indeed is what is happening. There are no limits whatsoever. There are no limits on owning guns, and there's no limits on going after abortion providers and abortion agencies.
But in the overall scheme of things, if you just in the political world, there's nothing more in terms of going nuclear than shutting down the government of the United States. You have to really feel that you've got some important issue there, that you're willing to shut down the government of the United States. And the House Republicans are and were and still are willing to shut down the government of the United States to defund Planned Parenthood. That's
right.
A fact.
Well, that is a fact that many of them are willing to do that. And there are many things that play into that. Of course, there is their belief that that people, you know, I think that more than the problem there is more than Planned Parenthood, in a sense, and that many people support Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is pretty, you know, America apple pie. This is where so many of us have gone for family planning. But, you know, many of the people who are against Planned Parenthood don't care about the government. They would like the government shut down for whatever reason possible because they don't believe in government.
Right, but just as this video of the purported harvesting of baby parts was phony, so is the argument over Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood it provides, I think, what 3% of its activities involved
services,
abortion.
Yeah.
97% of its activities are to do with women's health and women's reproductive health. And there is a law in the land known as the Hyde Amendment. It's been around for decades that prevents any government funding going into abortions. These are facts, but they don't enter into the political calculations of the anti-abortion movements.
No. Well, and underlying this, I mean, I think we do have to understand that you know, the people who want to close down Planned Parenthood know how the range of the work that Planned Parenthood does. And for them, there is this underlying cultural war that goes on, which is really about the fact that Planned Parenthood doesn't condemn anyone for the choices they make about their sexual lives within the boundary of consensual, respectful treatment of each other, doesn't condemn anybody for their sexual lives, doesn't insist that you be married, doesn't insist that you be straight, doesn't, in order to get treatment for sexually transmitted disease, doesn't insist on any of those things and treats you with respect. And that that is the problem that Carly Fiorina, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Ben Carson have with Planned Parenthood, that it is modern in terms of its understanding of sexual relationships, and it's not just about abortion. It's about that fact, and Planned Parenthood is popular. People like Planned Parenthood, so Planned Parenthood is in a sense an icon or a symbol of a society gone completely wrong, where sex outside of a monogamous heterosexual marriage is accepted, and it must be destroyed at all costs.
Right, but again,
don't you think that's what we're dealing with?
I agree with you, but the people that we're dealing with here, again, there's no consistency either intellectually, morally, or factually here. These conservatives believe that we got to get government out off your back, yet they want to impose government in the most private places of all, which is inside the bedroom. It's absolutely nuts, and yet they have been so successful. They're so relentless through the state houses across the country. They've introduced all kinds of laws. These laws are constantly butting up against Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court, and now they've got a case to the Supreme Court over the shutting down the Texas clinics, where they've really pretty much denied abortion care to abortion services to an enormous number of women in Texas, simply because they can't drive these long distances.
Of course not.
So I don't know what your feelings about that is. Obviously, one can't read the tea leaves, but you have to.
We're in very serious trouble. I think those of us who believe in the right and the need for individuals, women and men, to make choices about when and whether to have children, and that the responsible form of behavior is to use contraception, and when you don't want to have babies, and when you are unable to care for babies, or this is the wrong time, or you are facing a crisis, to be able to say this is not the time to bring a child into the world, that I would, and to have an abortion, that those are rational, compassionate, sensitive decisions that people have the right to make. Those of us who believe, and that we are also entitled to a life of a responsible sexuality and pleasure. Those of us who believe those things are, along with many other things that we would agree on, are in deep trouble in this country. These rights, these services are being restricted consistently. It's not, Planned Parenthood, again, these people know that Planned Parenthood provides a very significant amount of contraception, much more contraception than it does abortion. If we go back to Henry Hyde of the Hyde Amendment, Planned Parenthood prevented more abortions than Henry Hyde ever did. But we are in trouble, and I am quite pessimistic about the future of the availability of reproductive health services in this country. It is going to get more and more restricted. And we don't seem to be able to figure out, how to stop these people.
Well,
not a very optimistic thing to say, but that certainly is the case, is it not?
Well, it is. And if you go back to before Roe v. Wade, then you're back to these backstreet abortions, and the stories that come out of those eras are just so hideous. I was just reading a book about the actress Barbara Stanwyck. She could never have children because she had, when she was 18, had a backstreet abortion.
Abortion, right.
Yeah, and that was commonplace in those
that's
days.
Right.
So that's where we'll...
dangerous. Caused, damage to women's fertility and to women's health, as well as killing women. They don't care.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Frances Kissling. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with Frances Kissling, who's the president of the Center for Health, Ethics, and Social Policy and a former president of Catholics for Choice. She's a visiting scholar at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and serves on the advisory boards of the Journal of Feminist Ethics and the Women's Bioethics Project and writes a weekly column for Salon.com and blogs for ReligionDispatches.org. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into how much President Erdogan is responsible for Turkey's problems.
It has always been around, it will always have a niche, but they'll make it a privilege, not a right, accessible only to the rich. Hey, pro-lifers need to dig themselves, because life don't stop after birth, and for a child born to the unprepared, it might even just get worse. The situation would surely change if they were to find themselves in it. Supporters of the H-bomb and firebombing clinics.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And these compounding crises in Turkey, where President Erdogan has picked a fight with Vladimir Putin, he's reignited a war with the Kurds that's led to the public assassination of a prominent pro-Kurdish human rights lawyer, and he's using the refugee crisis as leverage to get concessions on joining the EU and aid to the refugees to keep them in Turkey. What are the limits to the sort of megalomaniacal and erratic behavior of this man? I mean, let's start with picking a fight with Putin. That's a really bad idea because Putin is going to go to the mat, isn't he?
It doesn't seem as though there are limits. Erdogan is picking a fight with everyone. Starting a war with Russia by shooting its plane down could really escalate. It's not in Turkey's interest to have a full-scale conflict with Russia. Russia's already imposed sanctions. Erdogan says he regrets that the events went in the direction they did and the plane was shot down. It's time that he reined himself in and was a little bit more circumspect about Turkey's role in the region and the world. No good is going to come of this to Turkey.
So that's short of an apology, right?
No apology, no compensation.
Right. But they are returning the body of the pilot. And by the way, could you explain to our audience what's going on there in that border area where the Russian plane was shot down and where one of the co-pilot escaped? The pilot was shot as he descended in his parachute by the Turkmen rebels. So who are they, whose side are they on, and what are they doing in that border area? And I understand that the Russians were able to bribe them into getting the other guy free.
So the Turkmen in Syria are an ethnic Turkish group. They live in primarily in Latakia province, along the border between Turkey and Syria. When Erdogan says that they're concerned about the fate of the Turkmen in Syria, you know, he's really obfuscating the truth. As in Iraq, Turkey just uses the Turkmen as pawns in pursuit of a broader political agenda. There's really no love for the Turkmen in Syria. And that area along the Turkey-Syrian border is getting increasingly crowded. Russia has a military base in Latakia. The Syrian Kurds have extended control of their state called Rojava, west of the Euphrates. They crossed the river and they were shot at by Turkish forces. The U.S. is supporting the Syrian Kurds to retake the border crossing at Talabiyad. They're proving to be the only effective fighting force against ISIS in Syria. So that area is very congested. The politics and security arrangements are messy. But let's not mistake the intervention by Turkey as a defense of the Syrian Turkmen. They really mean nothing to Ankara.
So why do you think they shot the plane down? Because there's some ambiguity as to whether it was actually in Turkish airspace. And if it was, it was only crossing over a sliver of it for a matter of seconds.
It was clearly an ambush. You know, they wanted to shoot the Russian plane down as a way of making a statement that this is Turkey's neighborhood. Turkey's going to have a seat at the table when there's a political settlement. You know, Russia can't project its force and its influence in a part of the world that Turkey sees as its own.
But surely did Erdogan make the calculation of what the blowback would be? Because Turkey is quite vulnerable to Russian sanctions, aren't they? Particularly their energy, gas comes from Russia. Now, on the other side, I imagine the Russians don't want to cut off the pipeline that they are planning to have delivered to their gas to Turkey because it goes on to Europe. But in terms of who has leverage over who, it would seem the Russians, in terms of economic sanctions, are sitting in the catbird seat.
The irony here, Ian, is that both Putin and Erdogan are cut out of the same cloth. They're both ultra-nationalists. They are both staunch supporters of the state, and they both see themselves as synonymous with the state. Turkey can be affected seriously by economic sanctions. I don't think that Erdogan calculated before the engagement orders were issued. Otherwise, he would have thought twice about picking a fight with Russia. Both men are emotional, stubborn, and impulsive. Now they're butting heads with one another.
Well, that's not a good thing.
Not a good thing, especially when we're trying to bring the parties together in Vienna and talk about a political transition. Syria's tragedy is that Syria is being treated as proxies by great powers in the Gulf, by Turkey, by Russia. Very hard for Syrians to get together and agree on some kind of power sharing when you've got these other countries driving the agenda whose interests are diametrically opposed. And Turkey is not a source of stability and peace in the region. Its support for jihadis beginning in 2011 is a major reason why we have the ISIS phenomena today. So there's a lot of responsibility for today's problems that rest personally with President Erdogan.
And again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Now, President Putin did, in fact, pretty much say what you just said then, David Phillips, in regard to Erdogan. He said, you know, he's blamed him for turning a blind eye to jihadists and also for the growing Islamification of the country.
He directly said that Erdogan was an accomplice to terror. And that's absolutely correct. Erdogan was deeply committed to getting rid of Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad. When the U.S. drew a red line and didn't enforce it, Turkey launched a campaign of wholesale support to jihadi groups. They opened the jihadi highway from Urfa to Raqqa in Syria, provided logistics, money, weapons. When jihadis were wounded on the battlefield, they were treated at no cost in Turkish hospitals. Now, ISIS is targeting Turkey. They see it as beholden to the West and against their Salafist ideals. So Turkey has essentially created a monster, and that monster is going to come back and bite it. Very short-sighted of Erdogan to support these extremist groups.
Well, the other thing that the other can of worms that he opened was, in order to get reelected, because he suffered an electoral defeat where he wanted to have this huge power grab and shift all of the power into the presidency. He lost that power grab. So then he has another election, and he ignites a war with the Kurds in order to create the conditions that got him elected. And now you've got blowback, at least it would seem so, with the public assassination of this prominent pro-Kurdish human rights lawyer. He was either killed by the PKK, which is unlikely, since he argued that the PKK should not be treated as a terrorist organization, or perhaps some of these grey wolves type right-wing Turkish nationalists, or even the MIT, the intelligence service. Who do you think was behind it?
So we don't know, but you know, there is a long history of the deep state in Turkey. In the past, it was part of the secular security establishment. These days, the deep state is an extension of the Islamist government of President Erdogan. And MIT, the National Intelligence Agency, has been involved in all kinds of staged events, which they make look as though they were part of the PKK, undertaken by the PKK. It was a deeply cynical move by Erdogan to restart Turkey's civil war simply to regain nationalist votes. It worked. You know, he now has the support that he needs in the parliament to undertake a constitutional reform and establish an executive presidency. But the cost of this is Turkey's peace and at home, a peace at home and abroad. The PKK and the Kurds of Turkey are not going to take this lying down. They're not going to let their intellectual elites be assassinated. PKK isn't going to stay across the border in Iraq and watch these atrocities committed against Kurds in Turkey. I'm afraid we're looking at a renewal of the civil war that we saw in the 1980s and 1990s, except more intense. 40,000 people have died already. It's cynical and shameful for Erdogan to have restarted the civil war just for short-term political expedient reasons.
So given that he has polarized the country so sharply, what's your sense then of the public getting cold feet and starting to reassess things vis-a-vis this man's megalomaniacal power grab and his cynicism?
So the authorities in Turkey really could care less about public opinion. And two prominent journalists were just arrested and charged with denigrating Turkishness because they reported on the National Intelligence Agency delivering weapons to ISIS. Erdogan doesn't govern in pursuit of public support. He governs in pursuit of his own interests and the interests of the state. So unfortunately, Turkey is stuck. They have Erdogan for four more years. They have an AKP-controlled parliament. There are very few checks on the government's power. We can see these protests, as we have over the weekend, but to what end? What opportunity do Turks have to hold their government in check? The system isn't built that way. Erdogan's personality doesn't tolerate it. I'm afraid we're going to see more polarization and more violence.
And in these meetings that have just taken place with the EU and Turkey over what to do about the flow of refugees from Syria, it looks as though Erdogan's used those that situation as leverage to get concessions out of Europe because they wanted to join the EU for the longest time. And certainly there's no excusing some of the rejectionists in Europe who seem, like the French, etc., seem to be quite racist in their objections to Turkey. But nevertheless, Turkey's reputation in Europe is surely damaged, isn't it? I mean, people, they may not be able to do anything about him in Turkey itself, but the rest of the Europe must know, see who he really is.
So Turkey was able to get a 3 billion euro contribution towards its border security, and that's because the Europeans are desperate to stem the flow of humanity from Turkey through the human corridor towards Germany. Part of the deal that Erdogan is demanding includes visa liberalization and intensified negotiation over Turkey's candidacy. The reality is that Turkey's candidacy is not a purely political decision. It's largely technical. And the European Commission just released its annual report on Turkey's criteria to become a member. And Turkey was bashed for its human rights records, its anti-democratic practices, Erdogan's authoritarianism. Europe doesn't want Turkey in its club, and Turkey isn't behaving as though it belongs there. Even visa liberalization, which would make it easier for Turks to travel to Europe, is a big stretch. Turkey has succeeded in alienating itself from Europe, isolating itself from the U.S. Within NATO, there was very little support after the air confrontation with the Russian jets. So right now, Turkey is as isolated as it has been in recent memory, and it's all a result of the policies that Erdogan's pursuing.
And you're pretty sure, David Phillips, that this doesn't bother Erdogan?
His goal is to establish his domestic authority as though he were a sultan of the 21st century. He seems impervious to these public criticisms. He's picked a fight with Russia, which is not a good idea. He's alienated his primary ally, the United States and NATO. He just doesn't seem to care. All he wants is to sit on the throne and be able to appoint to his accomplishments when Turkey has its centennial in 2020. That's not in the interests of Turkish citizens, and it's certainly not in the interests of U.S. security interests in the region.
So that's over 4 years away, and a lot can happen, surely.
Yep, a lot can happen. But Erdogan controls the levers of power, and he's constructed a system where there are very few checks and balances. He's going to move to constitutional reform to establish an executive presidency. I think that the greatest fear that Turkey has right now is that the groups that it supported in Syria are now going to pivot and redirect their terrorist activities against targets in Turkey. And then Turkey's going to have some serious buyer's remorse. I mean, look what we created, and look at the havoc that it's wrecking at home. On top of that, the conflict with the PKK and the Kurds means that Turkey's looking at a period of deep and continued instability.
Well, they've already had a taste of the blowback from Daesh, right, the Islamic State. And surely those bombings...
Have, a lot of these bombings that Turkey has attributed to Daesh, to the Islamic State, in my view, are actually engineered by the National Intelligence Agency. And Turkey is too quick to find the perpetrators, very quick to blame the PKK. Turkey is one of the most highly monitored and secure societies. If they really wanted to crack down and prevent these incidents from happening, it's well within their capacity. All of this is provocation from the government to create a problem that then only Erdogan can solve. That may have worked in the short term by virtue of the recent election results, but in the long term, it's not going to be in the interests of Turkey's peace and prosperity.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back with historical analogies to today's rejection of refugees.
I'm going there to see my mother.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Martin Goldsmith, who's a host and classical music programmer for Symphony Hall on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, who previously hosted NPR's daily classical music program Performance Today from 1989 to 1999. He's the author of The Inextinguishable Symphony, and his latest book is Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and a Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Martin Goldsmith.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And your book, Alex's Wake, of course, awakens, I think, a lot of analogies to what has been currently happening here in the last few weeks in the United States, particularly amongst U.S. governors and House Republicans and a number of Democrats voting to pause the intake of refugees from Syria, albeit a trickle to begin with. There seems to be an element of callousness here because, I mean, obviously, as bad as the Nazis were in many ways, these people in Syria are caught between two hideous forces, you know, the genocidal Assad regime and these absolutely cruel and inhuman jihadis with Daesh, the Islamic State. So I guess at the time of the St. Louis, it wasn't entirely clear that Hitler was creating a killing factories across the occupied lands, but it is pretty clear what's happening in Syria, surely.
Well, in 1939, at the time of the voyage of the St. Louis, I guess it's probably best to point out what the St. Louis was.
Sure.
This was a luxury liner owned by the Hamburg America line, and on the 13th of May, 1939, it departed Hamburg with more than 900 Jewish refugees. They were all paying full freight for the privilege of being booted out of their country in this rather nice way. They were bound for Cuba. Among those 900 passengers were my grandfather, Alex Goldschmidt, and my uncle, Helmut Goldschmidt. The plan was for the two of them to move to Cuba, essentially plant the family flag in the West, and then send for the rest of the family. But due to a high-level political infighting in the Cuban government, the ship was not allowed to land in Cuba. It then sailed north to the United States, where it was turned away by the government of Franklin Roosevelt. The ship was also turned away from Canada, and then it sailed back to Europe. A deal was brokered whereby the refugees on board the St. Louis could disembark in either England, France, Belgium, or Holland. My grandfather and uncle disembarked in France and then spent the next 3 years being shuttled from one French camp to another before being sent to Auschwitz and murdered in August of 1942. So that's the background of what happened on the St. Louis. But the somewhat chilling parallels to today is the fact that there were polls taken, opinion polls taken in the United States at that time, and there was a Roper poll which stated that 53% of Americans thought the Jews were different from other people and should be subject to restrictions on their business and social lives. That same poll found that only 39% of the respondents believed that Jews should be treated the same as everyone else, and fully 10% of the respondents to that poll thought that all Jews living in the United States should be deported. And there was a famous cartoon, a political cartoon, which ran in the New York Daily Mirror at the time of the St. Louis, and it showed the Statue of Liberty with her eyes averted and the sign hanging from her arm that holds the torch saying, "Keep out," which is what, as you pointed out, Ian, many American officials are now saying to Syrian refugees.
So where did the institutional anti-Semitism come from? Was it pervasive? Was it just in the State Department? I mean, well, actually, let's go back to Cuba. What was the political infighting there, and why, for example, one would have thought, was it a corrupt government? Would money have worked with them? What was the reason why they weren't allowed to ashore?
Well, speaking of money, there was an official high up in the Cuban government. His name was Benitez, and he took it upon himself to sell landing certificates onto Cuban soil to these refugees. So all of the refugees who boarded the St. Louis thought, well, if I want to disembark in Havana, I need one of these Benitez certificates, and they paid, you know, several hundred marks for the privilege of owning one of these certificates. But Mr. Benitez had pulled the same stunt with other ships, other refugees coming into Cuba, and he was making a nice profit. I mean, he probably kept 50 or 60 or 70% of the cost of these certificates and put it into his own pocket. And at this point, as the St. Louis was steaming westward from Hamburg, the president of Cuba, Federico Barru, decided that he didn't want to be a part of this arrangement anymore, and he declared that anybody who had one of these Benitez certificates didn't really have what they needed to land in Cuba. So he declared those certificates to be null and void. So, as I say, there were about 900-plus refugees on board the St. Louis, only a handful who happened to have other kinds of landing certificates were able to get off in Cuba.
And again, I'm speaking with Martin Goldsmith, who's the host and classical music programmer for Symphony Hall on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, who previously hosted NPR's daily classical music program Performance Today from 1989 to 1999. He's the author of The Inextinguishable Symphony, and his latest book is Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and a Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance. So let's turn then to FDR's State Department. Were they callously anti-Semitic, or what? I mean, I know that there were quotas, but we're talking about wealthy professionals coming to the United States. What was the problem?
Well, there was that poll I mentioned a couple
right.
months ago.
Right.
Let's not forget that in the late 1930s, well, goodness, stretching into the late 1950s and early 1960s, this was the era of, quote, restrictions, unquote. Jews were unable to check into many a fine hotel in this country. Jews were not allowed to join many country clubs in this country. I moved with my family to Cleveland in 1967, and we moved into a suburb of Cleveland called Shaker Heights. And Shaker Heights is a largely Jewish community, and yet the country club, Shaker Country Club, was restricted. In 1967, Jews were not allowed to be members of the country club. So going back to the 1930s, anti-Semitism was a pretty large part of daily life in this country, and the Roosevelt administration reflected that in large measure.
And the Canadians, you know, this is a very much an immigrant country, wasn't it, particularly in those days. What was their objection?
Well, the stated reason was that they didn't want this to become a precedent. But what was probably going on is that they saw what their powerful neighbor to the south had done, and they didn't want to run afoul of Washington at that time. Joseph Goebbels, the head of what was called the Department of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda for the German government at the time, just made propaganda hay out of this. He pointed out, oh, all of these other countries around the world who claim to love the Jews so much, look, they're turning their backs on the Jews, so I guess we'll have to take these shabby people back to us. Luckily, at least at that time, the ship did not go back to Germany, but was divided among those four countries I mentioned, although that did not help my grandfather or my uncle or several hundred other St. Louis passengers who eventually were murdered by the Nazis.
Well, my recollection of history is that back in the League of Nations, I'm not sure whether it was the San Remo conference of 1920 or another conference in Switzerland, but it was pretty clear that nobody wanted to take in the Jews, if you will, and of course the San Remo conference led to the Balfour Declaration. But my suspicion is that Hitler and company got that message.
Oh, absolutely. You know, David Ben-Gurion, who became one of the first leaders of the new State of Israel in 1948, said of that time, the late 30s and early 40s, that the world was divided into two parts, those places where the Jews could not live and those places where the Jews were not wanted. So, yes, I mean, this was a time when the U.S. was officially bound by the 1924 Immigration Act, and there were quotas for people coming from Germany, from Austria, other parts of the world, and only so many people were allowed into this country from those countries. And the argument went in June of 1939, as the St. Louis was plying the waters off the coast of Florida, if we let these 900 people in, people who have not filled out all the correct forms, et cetera, then we will have to shove other people back towards the back of the line, and that just would not be fair. I mean, that was the stated reason. Not long after that, the Assistant Secretary of State, a man by the name of Breckinridge Long, issued a memo to the Immigration Services of the State Department saying, in effect, we must postpone and postpone and postpone, make it much harder for these Jewish refugees to come into this country. Ostensibly, he was concerned that among the Jewish refugees were a number of Nazi spies. And again, Ian, echoes of what is happening now, when people say, well, we can't let Syrian refugees in because among the Syrian refugees there might be members of Daesh, there might be members of terrorist organizations. So it's very much, I hate to use the cliche, but we've seen this movie before.
So let's talk a little about the journey that you took in order to write this book, Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and A Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance. You followed your relative's footsteps on a 6-week journey of remembrance. So in the last few minutes, could you just take us quickly through that journey?
Sure. I was attempting to swim out of what I refer to as Alex's wake, which is the tragedy of his being murdered in Auschwitz. I realized with the help of my therapist and my wife that I operated with this question hanging over me, how can I ever be happy when my relatives were murdered in the Holocaust? And so I attempted to lose some of these feelings of guilt and shame by trying to save Alex and Helmut, which, of course, was totally irrational since they had been murdered 10 years before I was born. But my wife and I set out on this journey. We began in this little village called Sachsenhagen, where my grandfather was born in 1879. From there, we went to Oldenburg, where he had his very successful women's clothing store, and where he was arrested on the night of Kristallnacht, on November the 9th, 1938, which led to his seeking passage on the St. Louis. From there, we went to Hamburg, from where the ship sailed, and then we metaphorically met up with them in the town of Boulogne-sur-Mer, where they landed in France after being on the St. Louis for about 6 weeks. And from there, we went to Martigny-les-Bains and to Montauban, to Agde, to Rivesaltes, to Les Milles, to Drancy, and Auschwitz, going to all the places where my grandfather and uncle had been held during those 3 years between June of 1939 and August of 1942, when they were sent to Auschwitz. So we began where he was born, in Sachsenhagen. We ended in the village of Oswiecim, Poland, which is known in German as Auschwitz. So we went to all of those places to essentially to bear witness.
And many of them that you mentioned are in France, and the French, unfortunately, were Hitler's willing executioners, were they not?
Very much so. I think many of us know about the Nuremberg laws that were passed by the Nazis in September of 1935, which deprived the Jews of Germany of their citizenship and did other nasty things besides that. Well, on October 3rd, 1940, the extreme right-wing Vichy government of France passed what was called the Statut des Juifs, which was essentially a carbon copy of the Nuremberg laws. The Vichy government spelled out all the ways in which the Jews of France would be stripped of their civil rights, and they began rounding up Jews and building concentration camps. There were literally thousands of camps in France, and one of the reasons I wrote the book is that I think many of us know the names Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and Sachsenhausen and Dachau and Treblinka, but I think more of us need to know the names of Rivesaltes and Lemil and Gurs and Drancy and all of the many, many, many hundreds and thousands of camps that the French set up to get rid of the Jews of their country.
Well, just in closing, Martin Goldsmith, do you think that that there is a way to appeal to the better angels of our nature here in this somewhat toxic political discourse going on? Do you think that some of the ugliness that passes for a political discourse will eventually be shamed out of existence, or have we not bottomed out yet?
Ian, my fear is that we haven't bottomed out yet. I mean, we think to, I guess it was last year, when a number of children from South America sent north by their parents because of all kinds of violence in South American and Central American countries were sent north, and these children were met by the demonstrators in Texas and Arizona and California, you know, carrying signs and yelling at these little children, and that was not caused by the sort of fear that has been let loose in the world and in this country since Paris, fears that have been stoked and encouraged by politicians. So I'm afraid that things are going to get worse before they get better, assuming they do get better.
Well, we can only hope. And I thank you for enlightening us on this extraordinary story and this extraordinary journey that you took, Martin Goldsmith. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Martin Goldsmith, who's the host and classical music programmer for Symphony Hall on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, who previously hosted NPR's daily classical music program Performance Today from 1989 to 1999. He's the author of The Inextinguishable Symphony, and his latest book is Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and a Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.